and leaning over it casually, I spot the only name for 2 at 9 with a line drawn through it, which happens to be, oh Jesus, Schrotz. I sigh and tapping my foot, my mind racing, I try to concoct some kind of feasible plan. Suddenly I turn to Jean and say, why don't you go to the women's room? She's looking around the restaurant, taking it in. Chaos. People are waiting 10 deep at the bar. The maitre d' seats the couple at a table in the middle of the room. Sylvester Stallone and a bimbo sit in the front booth that Sean and I sat in just weeks before, much to my sickened amazement. And his bodyguards are piled into the booth next to that. And the owner of Petty's, Norman Prager, lounges in the third. Jean turns her head to me and shouts, what? Over the din. Don't you want to use the ladies' room? I ask. The maitre d' nears us, picking his way through the packed restaurant, unsmiling. Why? I mean, do I? She asks, totally confused. Just go, I hiss, desperately squeezing her arm. But I don't need to go, Patrick, she protests. Oh, Christ, I mutter. Now it's too late anyway. The maitre d' walks up to the podium and inspects the book, takes a phone call, hangs up in a matter of seconds, then looks us over, not exactly displeased. The maitre d' is at least 50 and has a ponytail. I clear my throat twice to get his full attention, make some kind of lame eye contact. Yes, he asks as if harassed. I give him a dignified expression before sighing inside. Reservations at 9, I gulp, for 2. Yes, he asks suspiciously, drawing the word out. Name? He says, then turns to a passing waiter, 18 and model handsome, who'd asked, where's the ice? He's glaring and shouting, not now, okay? How many times do you need to be told? The waiter shrugs humbly, and then the maitre d' points off toward the bar. The ice is over there. He turns back to us, and I am genuinely frightened. Name, he commands, and I'm thinking, of all the fucking names, why this one? Schrotz, oh God. Mr. and Mrs. Schrotz. My face, I'm sure, is ashen, and I say the name mechanically, but the maitre d' is too busy to not buy it. And I don't even bother to face Jean, who I'm sure is totally bewildered by my behavior, as we're led to the Schrotz's table, which I'm sure probably sucks, though I'm relieved anyway. Menus already lie on the table. But I'm so nervous the words and even the prices look like hieroglyphics, and I'm completely at a loss. A waiter takes our drink order, the same one who couldn't locate the ice, and I find myself saying things without listening to Jean, like, protecting the ozone layer is a really cool idea, and telling knock-knock jokes. I smile, fixing it on my face, in another country, and it takes no time at all, minutes really. The waiter doesn't even get a chance to tell us about the specials, for me to notice the tall, handsome couple by the podium, conferring with the maitre d', and after sighing very deeply, lightheaded, stammering, I mention to Jean, something bad is happening. She looks up from the menu and puts down the iceless drink she's been sipping. Why, what's wrong? The maitre d' is glaring over at us, at me, from across the room, as he leads the couple toward our table. If the couple had been short, dumpy, excessively Jewish, I could have kept this table, even without the aid of a 50. But this couple looks like they've just strolled out of a Ralph Lauren ad, and though Jean and I do too, and so does the rest of the whole goddamn restaurant, the man is wearing a tuxedo, and the girl, a totally fuckable babe, is covered with jewels. This is reality, and as my loathsome brother Sean would say, I have to deal with it. The maitre d' now stands at the table, hands clasped behind his back, unamused, and after a long pause asks, Mr. and Mrs. Schrotz? Yes? I play it cool. He just stares. This is accompanied by an abnormal silence. His ponytail, gray and oily, hangs like some kind of malignancy below his collar. You know, I finally say, somewhat suavely, I happen to know the chef. he continues staring. So, no doubt, does the couple behind him. After another long pause, for no real reason, I ask, "Is he in Aspen?" This is getting nowhere. I sigh and turn to Jean, who looks completely mystified. "Let's go, okay?" She nods, dumbly. Humiliated, I take Jean's hand and we get up, she slower than I, brushing past the maitre d' and the couple, and make our way back through the crowded restaurant, and then we're outside, and I'm utterly devastated and murmuring robotically to myself, "I should have known better, I should have known better, I should." But Jean skips down the street laughing, pulling me along. And when I finally notice her unexpected mirth, between giggles she lets out, "That was so funny." And then, squeezing my clenched fist, she lets me know, "Your sense of humor is so spontaneous." Shaken, walking stiffly by her side, ignoring her, I ask myself, "Where to now?" And in seconds come up with an answer, Arcadia, toward which I find myself guiding us. After someone who I think is Hamilton Conway mistakes me for someone named Ted Owen and asks if I can get him into Petty's tonight, I tell him I'll see what I can do, then turn what's left of my attention to Jean, who sits across from me in the near-empty dining room of Arcadia. After he leaves, only 5 of the restaurant's tables have people at them. I've ordered a J&B on the rocks. Jean sipping a glass of white wine and talking about how what she really wants to do is get into merchant banking. And I'm thinking, dare to dream. Someone else, Frederick Dibble, stops by and congratulates me on the Larson account, and then has the nerve to say, "Talk to you later, Saul." But I'm in a daze, millions of miles away, and Jean doesn't notice. She's talking about a new novel she's been reading by some young author. Its cover I've seen, slathered with neon, its subject, lofty suffering. Accidentally, I think she's talking about something else, and I find myself saying, without really looking over at her, "You need a tough skin to survive in this city." She flushes, seems embarrassed, and takes another sip of the wine, which is a nice Sauvignon Blanc.
"You seem distant," she says.
"What?" I ask, blinking.
"I said you seem distant," she says.
"No," I sigh. "I'm still my same kooky self."
"That's good."
She smiles. Am I dreaming this? Relieved. "So listen," I say, trying to focus in on her. "What do you really want to do with your life?" Then remembering how she was droning on about a career in merchant banking, I add, "Just briefly, you know, summarize." Then I add, "And don't tell me you enjoy working with children, okay?"
"Well, I'd like to travel," she says, "and maybe go back to school, but I really don't know."
She pauses thoughtfully and announces sincerely,
"I'm at a point in my life where there seems to be a lot of possibilities, but I'm so, I don't know, unsure."
"I think it's also important for people to realize their limitations." Then out of the blue I ask, "Do you have a boyfriend?" She smiles shyly, blushes, and then says,
"No, not really."
"Interesting," I murmur. I've opened my menu and I'm studying tonight's prefix dinner.
"Are you seeing anyone?" she ventures timidly. "I mean, seriously?"
I decide on the pilot fish with tulips and cinnamon, evading the question by sighing, "I just want to have a meaningful relationship with someone special." And before she's allowed to respond, I ask her what she's going to order.
"I think the mahi-mahi," she says, and then, squinting at the menu, "with ginger."
"I'm having the pilot fish," I say. "I'm developing a taste for them, for pilot fish," I say, nodding. Later, after a mediocre dinner, a bottle of expensive California Cabernet Sauvignon and a creme brulee that we share, I order a glass of $50 port, and Jean sips a decaffeinated espresso. And when she asks where the restaurant got its name, I tell her, and I don't make anything ridiculous up, though I'm tempted just to see if she'd believe it anyway. Sitting across from Jean right now in the darkness of Arcadia,
it's very easy to believe that she would swallow any kind of misinformation I push her way. The crush she has on me rendering her powerless, and I find this lack of defense oddly unerotic. I could even explain my pro-apartheid stance and have her find reasons why she too should share them, and invest large sums of money in racist corporations that Arcadia was an ancient region in Peloponnesus, Greece, which was founded in 370 BC, and it was completely surrounded by mountains. Its chief city was Megalopolis, which was also the center of political activity, and the capital of the Arcadian Confederacy. I take a sip of the port, which is thick, strong, expensive. It was destroyed during the Greek War of Independence. I pause again. Pan was worshipped originally in Arcadia. Do you know who Pan was? Never taking her eyes off me, she nods. His revels were very similar to those of Bacchus, I tell her. He frolicked with nymphs at night, but he also liked to frighten travelers during the day, hence the word panic. Blah, blah, blah. I'm amused that I've retained this knowledge, and I look up from the port I've been staring thoughtfully into and smile at her. She's silent for a long time, confused, unsure of how to respond. But eventually she looks deeply into my eyes and says, haltingly, leaning across the table, "That's so interesting," which is all that comes out of her mouth, is all she has to say. 11:34. We stand on the sidewalk in front of Jean's apartment on the Upper East Side. Her doorman eyes us warily and fills me with a nameless dread, his gaze piercing me from the lobby. A curtain of stars, miles of them, are scattered, glowing across the sky, and their multitude humbles me, which I have a hard time tolerating. She shrugs and nods after I say something about forms of anxiety. It's as if her mind is having a hard time communicating with her mouth, as if she is searching for a rational analysis of who I am, which is, of course, an impossibility. There is no key. "Dinner was wonderful," she says. "Thank you very much." "Actually, the food was mediocre, but you're welcome," I shrug. "Do you want to come up for a drink?" she asks too casually, and even though I'm critical of her approach, it doesn't necessarily mean that I don't want to go up. But something stops me. Something quells the bloodlust. The doorman, the way the lobby is lit, her lipstick. Plus, I'm beginning to think that pornography is so much less complicated than actual sex, and because of this lack of complication, so much more pleasurable. "Do you have any peyote?" I ask. She pauses, confused. "What?" "Just a joke," I say. Then, "Listen, I want to watch David Letterman, so..." I pause, unsure as to why I'm lingering. "I should go."
"You can watch it," she stops, then suggests, "at my place."
I pause before asking, "Do you have cable?"
"Yes," she nods, "I have cable."
Stuck, I pause again, then pretend to mull it over. "No, it's okay. I like to watch it without cable." She offers a sad, perplexed glance.
"What?"
"I have to return some videotapes," I explain in a rush. She pauses.
"Now?"
"It's..." She checks her watch.
"Almost midnight."
"Well, yeah," I say, considerably detached.
"Well, I guess it's good night, then," she says.
What kind of books does Jean read? Titles race through my mind. How to Make a Man Fall in Love with You. How to Keep a Man in Love with You Forever. How to Close a Deal. Get Married. How to Be Married 1 Year from Today. Supplicant. In my overcoat pocket I finger the ostrich condom case from Luc Benoit I bought last week, but, no. After awkwardly shaking hands, she asks, still holding mine,
"Really? You don't have cable?"
And though it has been in no way a romantic evening, she embraces me, and this time emanates a warmth I'm not familiar with.
I am so used to imagining everything happening the way it occurs in movies, visualizing things falling somehow into the shape of events on a screen, that I almost hear the swelling of an orchestra, can almost hallucinate the camera panning low around us, fireworks bursting in slow motion overhead, the 70-millimeter image of her lips parting, and the subsequent murmur of, "I want you," in Dolby Sound. But my embrace is frozen, and I realize, at first distantly, and then with greater clarity, that the havoc raging inside me is gradually subsiding, and she is kissing me on the mouth, and this jars me back into some kind of reality, and I lightly push her away. She glances up at me fearfully. "Listen, I've gotta go," I say, checking my Rolex. "I don't wanna miss stupid pet tricks." "Okay," she says, composing herself. "Bye." "Night," I say. We both head off in our separate directions, but suddenly she calls out something. I turn around. "Don't forget, you have a breakfast meeting with Frederick Bennett and Charles Rust at 21, she says from the door, which the doorman is holding open for her. "Thanks," I call out, waving. "It slipped my mind completely." She waves back, disappearing into the lobby. On my way over to Park Avenue, to find a cab, I pass an ugly homeless bum, a member of the genetic underclass, and when he softly pleads for change, for anything, I notice the Barnes & Noble book bag that sits next to him on the steps of the church he's begging on, and I can't help but smirk, out loud, "Oh, right, like you read." And then in the back of the cab on the way across town to my apartment, I imagine running around Central Park on a cool spring afternoon with Jean, laughing, holding hands. We buy balloons. We let them go. Detective. May slides into June, which slides into July, which creeps toward August. Because of the heat, I've had intense dreams the last 4 nights about vivisection, and I'm doing nothing now, vegetating in my office with a sickening headache and a Walkman with a soothing Kenny G CD playing in it. But the bright mid-morning sunlight floods the room, piercing my skull, causing my hangover to throb, and because of this, there's no workout this morning. Listening to the music, I notice the second light on my phone blinking off and on, which means that Jean is buzzing me. I sigh and carefully remove the Walkman. "What is it?" I ask in monotone.
"Patrick," she begins.
"Yes, Jean?" I ask condescendingly, spacing the two words out.
"Patrick, Mr. Donald Kimball is here to see you," she says nervously.
"Who?" I snap, distracted. She emits a small sigh of worry, then, as if asking, lowers her voice.
"Detective Donald Kimball?"
I pause, staring out the window into sky, then at my monitor, then at the headless woman I've been doodling on the back cover of this week's Sports Illustrated, and I run my hand over the glossy finish of the magazine once, twice, before tearing the cover off and crumpling it up. Finally, I start. "Tell him..." Then, mulling it over, rethinking my options, I stop and begin again. "Tell him I'm at lunch." Jean pauses, then whispers,
"Patrick, I think he knows you're here."
During my protracted silence, she adds, still hushed,
"It's 10:30.
I sigh, stalling again, and in a contained panic tell Jean, "Send him in, I guess." I stand up, walk over to the Jody mirror that hangs next to the George Stubbs painting and check my hair, running an oxhorn comb through it. Then, calmly, I pick up one of my cordless phones and, preparing myself for a tense scene, pretend to be talking with John Akers, and I start enunciating clearly into the phone before the detective enters the office. "Now, John," I clear my throat. "You've got to wear clothes in proportion to your physique," I begin, talking to nobody. "There are definitely do's and don'ts, good buddy, of wearing a bold striped shirt. A bold-striped shirt calls for solid-colored or discreetly patterned suits and ties." The door to the office opens, and I wave in the detective, who is surprisingly young, maybe my age,
wearing a linen Armani suit, not unlike mine. Though his is slightly disheveled in a hip way, which worries me. I offer a reassuring smile. And a shirt with a high yarn count means it's more durable than one that doesn't. Yes, I know. But to determine this, you've got to examine the material's weave. I point to the Mark Schrager chrome and teak chair on the opposite side of my desk, silently urging him to sit. Tightly woven fabric is created not only by using a lot of yarn, but by using yarn of high-quality fibers, both long and thin, which fabricate a close weave, as opposed to short and stubbly fibers, like those found in tweed. And loosely woven fabrics, such as knits, are extremely delicate and should be treated with great care. Because of the detective's arrival, it seems unlikely that this will be a good day, and I eye him warily as he takes the seat and crosses his legs in a way that fills me with a nameless dread. I realize I've been quiet too long when he turns around to see if I'm off the phone. Right, and... Yes, John, right. And... Yes, always tip the stylish 15%. I pause. No, the owner of the salon shouldn't be tipped. I shrug at the detective, hopelessly rolling my eyes. He nods, smiles understandingly, and recrosses his legs. Nice socks. Jesus. The girl who washes the hair? It depends. I'd say a dollar or two. I laugh. Depends on what she looks like. I laugh harder. And yeah, what else she washes. I pause again, then say, Listen, John, I've got to go. T. Boone Pickens just walked in. I pause, grinning like an idiot, then laugh. Just joking. Another pause. No, don't tip the owner of the salon. I laugh once more, then finally, Okay, John. Right. Got it. I hang up the phone, push its antenna down, and then, uselessly stressing my normality, say, Sorry about that. No, I'm sorry, he says, genuinely apologetic. I should have made an appointment. Gesturing toward the cordless phone I'm placing back in its recharging cradle, he asks, Was that, anything important? Oh, that, I ask, moving toward my desk, sinking into my chair, just mulling over business problems, examining opportunities, exchanging rumors, spreading gossip. We both laugh. The ice breaks. Hi, he says, sitting up, holding out his hand. I'm Donald Kimball. Hi, Pat Bateman. I take it, squeezing it firmly. Nice to meet you. I'm sorry, he says, to barge in on you like this, but I was supposed to talk to Lewis Carruthers, and he wasn't in, and... Well, you're here, so... He smiles, shrugs. I know how busy you guys can get. He averts his eyes from the three copies of Sports Illustrated that lie open atop my desk, covering it, along with the Walkman. I notice them, too, then close all three issues and slip them into the desk's top drawer, along with the still-running Walkman. So, I start, trying to come off as friendly and conversational as possible. What's the topic of discussion? Well, he starts, I've been hired by Meredith Powell to investigate the disappearance of Paul Owen. I nod thoughtfully before asking, You're not with the FBI or anything, are you? No, no, he says, nothing like that. I'm just a private investigator. Ah, I see, yes. I nod again, still not relieved. Paul's disappearance, yes. So it's nothing that official, he confides. I just have some basic questions about Paul Owen, about yourself. Coffee? I ask suddenly. As if unsure, he says, No, I'm okay. Perrier, San Pellegrino? I offer. No, I'm okay, he says again, opening a small black notebook he's taken out of his pocket, along with a gold cross pen. I buzz Jean. Yes, Patrick? Jean, can you bring Mr.... I stop, look up. He looks up too. Kimball. Mr. Kimball, a bottle of San Pella... Oh no, I'm okay, he protests. It's no problem, I tell him. I get the feeling he's trying not to stare at me strangely. He turns back to his notebook and writes something down, then crosses something out. Jean walks in almost immediately, and she places the bottle of San Pellegrino and a Steuben-etched glass tumbler on my desk in front of Kimball. She gives me a fretful, worried glance, which I scowl at. Kimball looks up, smiles, and nods at Jean, who I notice is not wearing a bra today. Innocently, I watch her leave, then return my gaze to Kimball, clasping my hands together, sitting up. "Well, what's the topic of discussion?" I say again. "The disappearance of Paul Owen," he says, reminding me. "Oh, right. Well, I haven't heard anything about the disappearance or anything." I pause, then try to laugh. "Not on page 6, at least." Kimball smiles politely. I think his family wants this kept quiet. "Understandable." I nod at the untouched glass and bottle, and then look up at him. "Lyme?" "No, really," he says. "I'm okay." "You sure?" I ask. "I can always get you a lime." He pauses briefly, then says, "Just some preliminary questions that I need for my own files, okay?"
"Shoot,"
I say.
"How old are you?" he asks.
27, I say. "I'll be 28 in October."
"Where did you go to school?"
He scribbles something in his book.
"Harvard,"
I tell him, "then Harvard Business School."
"Your address?"
he asks, looking only at his book. 55 West 81st Street, I say, "the American Gardens building."
"Nice,"
he looks up, impressed. "Very nice."
"Thanks,"
I smile, flattered.
"Doesn't Tom Cruise live there?"
he asks.
"Yep."
I squeeze the bridge of my nose. Suddenly I have to close my eyes tightly. I hear him speak.
"Pardon me, but are you okay?"
Opening my eyes, both of them tearing, I say,
"Why do you ask?"
"You seem nervous." I reach into a drawer in my desk and bring out a bottle of aspirin.
"Nuprin?"
I offer. Kimball looks at the bottle strangely and then back at me before shaking his head.
No, thanks.
He's taken out a pack of Marlboros and absently lays it next to the San Pellegrino bottle while studying something in the book.
"Bad habit," I point out.
He looks up, and noticing my disapproval, smiles sheepishly. "I know, I'm sorry." I stare at the box.
Would you rather I not smoke?"
he asks, tentative. I continue to stare at the cigarette packet, debating.
"No, I guess it's okay."
"You sure?"
he asks.
"No problem," I buzz Jean.
"Yes, Patrick?"
"Bring us an ashtray for Mr. Kimball, please," I say. In a matter of seconds, she does.
"What can you tell me about Paul Owen?"
he finally asks, after Jean leaves, having placed a Fortunoff crystal ashtray on the desk next to the untouched San Pellegrino. "Well," I cough, swallowing 2 Nuprin dry, "I didn't know him that well."
"How well did you know him?"
he asks.
"I'm at a loss," I tell him somewhat truthfully. "He was part of that whole Yale thing, you know?"
"Yale thing?" he asks, confused. I pause, having no idea what I'm talking about.
"Yeah, Yale thing."
"What do you mean, Yale thing?" Now he's intrigued. I pause again. "What do I mean?" "Well, I think, for one, that he was probably a closet homosexual." I have no idea. Doubt it, considering his taste in babes, who did a lot of cocaine. I pause, then add a bit shakily, "That Yale thing." I'm sure I say this bizarrely, but there's no other way to put it. It's very quiet in the office right now. The room suddenly seems cramped and sweltering, and even though the air conditioning is on full blast, the air seems fake, recycled.
"So,"
Kimball looks at his book helplessly, "there's nothing you can tell me about Paul Owen." "Well," I sigh, "he led what I suppose was an orderly life, I guess." Really stumped, I offer, "he ate a balanced diet." I'm sensing frustration on Kimball's part, and he asks, "What kind of man was he, besides..." He falters, tries to smile. "The information you've just given." How could I describe Paul Owen to this guy? Boasting, arrogant, cheerful dickhead who constantly weaseled his way out of checks at Nell's? That I'm heir to the unfortunate information that his penis had a name, and that name was Michael? No. Calmer, Bateman. I think that I'm smiling. "I hope I'm not being cross-examined here," I manage to say. "Do you feel that way?" he asks. The question sounds sinister, but isn't. "No," I say carefully. "Not really." Maddeningly, he writes something else down, then asks, without looking up, chewing on the tip of the pen, "Where did Paul hang out?" "Hang out?" I ask. "Yeah," he says, "you know, hang out." "Let me think," I say, tapping my fingers across my desk. "The Newport, Harry's, Flutie's, Indochine, Nell's, Cornell Club, the New York Yacht Club, the regular places." Kimball looks confused. "He had a yacht?" Stuck, I casually say, "No, he just hung out there." "And where did he go to school?" he asks. I pause. "Don't you know this?" "I just wanted to know if you know," he says without looking up. Yale, I say slowly. "Right?" "Right." "And then to business school at Columbia," I add, "I think." "Before all that?" he asks. "If I remember correctly, St. Paul's. I mean..." "No, it's okay, that's not really pertinent," he apologizes. "I just have no other questions, I guess. I don't have a lot to go on." "Listen, I start softly, tactfully. "I just want to help." "I understand," he says. Another long pause. He marks something down, but it doesn't seem important. "Anything else you can tell me about Owen?" he asks, sounding almost timid. I think about it, then feebly announce, "We were both 7 in 1969. Kimball smiles. "So was I." Pretending to be interested in the case, I ask, "Do you have any witnesses or fingerprints?" He cuts me off tiredly. "Well, there's a message on his answering machine saying he went to London." "Well," I ask then hopefully, "maybe he did, huh?" "His girlfriend doesn't think so," Kimball says tonelessly. Without even beginning to understand, I imagine, what a speck Paul Owen was in the overall enormity of things. "But," I stop, "has anyone seen him in London?" Kimball looks at his book, flips over a page, and then, looking back at me, says, "Actually, yes." "Hmm," I say. "Well, I've had a hard time getting an accurate verification," he admits. "Stephen Hughes says he saw him at a restaurant there, but I checked it out, and what happened is he mistook a Hubert Ainsworth for Paul, so..." "Oh," I say. "Do you remember where you were on the night of Paul's disappearance?" He checks his book. "Which was on the 24th of June? "Gosh, I guess..." I think about it. "I was probably returning videotapes." I open my desk drawer, take out my date book, and looking through December, announce, "I had a date with a girl named Veronica." I'm completely lying, totally making this up. "Wait," he says, confused, looking at his book. "That's not what I've got." My thigh muscles tense. "What?" "That's not the information I've received," he says. "Well..." I'm suddenly confused and scared, the Nuprin bitter in my stomach. Wait. "What information have you received?" "Let's see." He flips through his pad, finds something. "That you were with..." "Wait," I laugh. "I could be wrong." My spine feels damp. "Well," he stops, "when was the last time you were with Paul Owen?" he asks. We had, oh my God, Bateman, think up something, gone to a new musical that just opened called Oh Africa, Brave Africa. I gulp. It was a laugh riot, and that's about it. I think we had dinner at Orso's. No, Petaluma. No, Orso's. I stop. The last time I physically saw him was at an automated teller. I can't remember which. Just one that was near, Nell's. But the night he disappeared? Kimball asks. I'm not really sure, I say. I think maybe you've got your dates mixed up, he says, glancing at his book. But how? I ask. Where do you place Paul that night? According to his date book, and this was verified by his secretary, he had dinner with Marcus Halberstam, he says. And? I ask. I've questioned him. Marcus? Yes. And he denies it, Kimball says, though at first he couldn't be sure. But Marcus denied it. Yes. Well, does Marcus have an alibi? I have a heightened receptivity to his answers now. Yes. Pause. He does? I ask. You're sure? I checked it out, he says with an odd smile. It's clean. Pause. Oh. Now where were you? He laughs. I laugh too, though I'm not sure why. Where was Marcus? I'm almost giggling. Kimball keeps smiling as he looks me over. He wasn't with Paul Owen, he says enigmatically. So who was he with? I'm laughing still, but I'm also very dizzy. Kimball opens his book, and for the first time gives me a slightly hostile look. He was at Atlantis, with Craig McDermott, Frederick Dibble, Harry Newman, George Butner, and... Kimball pauses, then looks up. You. In this office right now, I am thinking about how long it would take a corpse to disintegrate right in this office. In this office, these are the things I fantasize about while dreaming, eating ribs at Red Hot and Blue in Washington, D.C. If I should switch shampoos, what really is the best dry beer? Is Bill Robinson an overrated designer? What's wrong with IBM? Ultimate luxury. Is the term playing hardball an adverb? The fragile piece of Assisi. Electric light. The epitome of luxury. Of ultimate luxury. The bastards wearing the same damn Armani linen suit I've got on. How easy it would be to scare the living wits out of this fucking guy. Kimball is utterly unaware of how truly vacant I am. There is no evidence of animate life in this office, yet still he takes notes. By the time you finish reading this sentence, a Boeing jetliner will take off or land somewhere in the world. I would like a Pilsner or Quell. Oh, right, I say. Of course, we had wanted Paul Owen to come, I say, nodding my head as if just realizing something. But he said he had plans. Then lamely, I guess I had dinner with Victoria the following night. Listen, like I said, I was just hired by Meredith. He sighs, closing his book. Tentatively, I ask, did you know that Meredith Powell is dating Brock Thompson? He shrugs, sighs. I don't know about that. All I know is that Paul Owen owes her supposedly a lot of money. Oh, I say, nodding, really? Personally, he says, confiding, I think the guy went a little nutso. Split town for a while, maybe he did go to London. Sightseeing, drinking, whatever. Anyway, I'm pretty sure he'll turn up sooner or later. I nod slowly, hoping to look suitably bewildered. Was he involved at all, do you think, in, say, occultism or Satan worship? Kimball asks seriously. What? I know it sounds like a lame question, but in New Jersey last month, I don't know if you've heard about this, but a young stockbroker was recently arrested and charged with murdering a young Chicano girl and performing voodoo rituals with, well, various body parts.
Yikes, I exclaim.
And, I mean, he smiles sheepishly again. Have you heard anything about this?
Did the guy deny doing it? I ask, tingling.
Right, Kimball nods.
That was an interesting case, I manage to say. Even though the guy says he's innocent, he still thinks he's Inca, the bird god or something, Kimball says, scrunching his features up.
We both laugh out loud about this.
No, I finally say.
Paul wasn't into that. He followed a balanced diet and...
Yeah, I know, and was into that whole Yale thing, Kimball finishes tiredly. There is a long pause that I think might be the longest one so far.
Have you consulted a psychic? I ask.
No. He shakes his head in a way that suggests he's considered it.
Oh, who cares?
Had his apartment been burglarized? I ask.
No, it actually hadn't, he says. Toiletries were missing. A suit was gone. So was some luggage. That's it.
Do you suspect foul play?
Can't say, he says. But like I told you, I wouldn't be surprised if he's just hiding out someplace.
I mean, no one's dealing with the homicide squad yet, or anything, right? I ask.
No, not yet. As I said, we're not sure, but...
He stops, looks dejected. Basically, no one has seen or heard anything.
That's so typical, isn't it? I ask.
It's just strange, he agrees, staring out the window, lost. One day someone's walking around, going to work, alive, and then...
Kimball stops, fails to complete the sentence.
Nothing, I sigh, nodding.
People just disappear, he says.
The earth just opens up and swallows people, I say somewhat sadly, checking my Rolex.
Eerie, Kimball yawns, stretching. Really eerie.
Ominous, I nod my agreement.
It's just, he sighs, exasperated, futile.
I pause, unsure of what to say, and come up with,
futility is hard to deal with.
I am thinking about nothing. It's silent in the office. To break it, I point out a book on top of the desk, next to the San Pellegrino bottle, The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump.
Have you read it?
I ask Kimball.
No, he sighs, but politely asks, is it any good?
It's very good, I say, nodding.
Listen, he sighs again, I've taken up enough of your time.
He pockets the Marlboros.
I have a lunch meeting with Cliff Huxtable at the Four Seasons in 20 minutes anyway. I lie, standing up. I have to go, too.
Isn't the Four Seasons a little far uptown? He looks concerned, also getting up. I mean, aren't you going to be late?
No. I stall. There's one down here.
Oh, really? He asks. I didn't know that.
Yes, I say, leading him to the door. It's very good.
Listen, he says, turning to face me. If anything occurs to you, any information at all, I hold up a hand.
Absolutely. I'm 100% with you, I say solemnly.
Great, the ineffectual one says, relieved. And thanks for your, time, Mr. Bateman.
Moving him toward the door, my legs wobbly, astronaut-like, leading him out of the office, though I'm empty, devoid of feeling, I still sense, without deluding myself, that I've accomplished something. And then, anticlimactically, we talk for a few minutes more about razor-burn bombs and Tattersall shirts. There was an odd general lack of urgency to the conversation that I found soothing. Nothing happened at all. But when he smiles, hands me his card, leaves, the door closing sounds to me like a billion insects screaming, pounds of bacon sizzling, a vast emptiness. And after he leaves the building, I have Gene buzz Tom at security to make sure. I call someone recommended by my lawyer to make sure none of my phones are wiretapped. And after a Xanax, I'm able to meet with my nutritionist at an expensive upscale health food restaurant called Cuisine de Soy in Tribeca. And while sitting beneath the dolphin,
stuffed and shellacked, that hangs over the tofu bar, its body bent into an arc, I'm able to ask the nutritionist questions like, "Okay, so give me the muffin lowdown," without cringing. Back at the office, 2 hours later, I find out that none of my phones are tapped. I also run into Meredith Powell later this week, on Friday night at Eri's with Brock Thompson. And though we talk for 10 minutes, mostly about why neither one of us is in the Hamptons, with Brock glaring at me the entire time, she doesn't mention Paul Owen once. I'm having an excruciatingly slow dinner with my date, Jeanette. The restaurant is flashy and new, and the meal inches along, drags by. The portions are meager. I grow increasingly agitated. Afterwards, I want to bypass MK, even though Jeanette complains because she wants to dance. I'm tired and I need to rest. At my apartment, I lie in bed, too distracted to have sex with her, so she leaves, and after watching a tape of this morning's Patty Winters show, which is about the best restaurants in the Middle East, I pick up my cordless phone and tentatively, reluctantly, call Evelyn. Summer. Most of the summer I spent in a stupor, sitting either in my office or in new restaurants, in my apartment watching videotapes, or in the backs of cabs, in nightclubs that just opened or in movie theaters, at the building in Hell's Kitchen or in new restaurants. There were 4 major air disasters this summer, the majority of them captured on videotape, almost as if these events had been planned and repeated on television endlessly. The planes kept crashing in slow motion, followed by countless roaming shots of the wreckage and the same random views of the burned, bloody carnage, weeping rescue workers retrieving body parts. I started using Oscar de la Renta men's deodorant, which gave me a slight rash. A movie about a small talking bug was released to great fanfare and grossed over $200 million. The Mets were doing badly. Beggars and homeless seemed to have multiplied in August, and the ranks of the unfortunate weak and aged lined the streets everywhere. I found myself asking too many summer associates at too many dinners in flashy new restaurants before taking them to Les Miserables if anyone had seen the Toolbox Murders on HBO, and silent tables would stare back at me before I would cough politely and summon the waiter over for the check, or I'd ask for sorbet, or, if this was earlier in the dinner, for another bottle of San Pellegrino. And then I'd ask the summer associates, "No?" and assure them, "It was quite good." My platinum American Express card had gone through so much use that it snapped in half, self-destructed at one of those dinners when I took 2 summer associates to Restless and Young, the new Pablo Lester restaurant in Midtown. But I had enough cash in my gazelle skin wallet to pay for the meal. The Patty Winters shows were all repeats. Life remained a blank canvas, a cliché, a soap opera. I felt lethal, on the verge of frenzy. My nightly bloodlust overflowed into my days, and I had to leave the city. My mask of sanity was a victim of impending slippage. This was the bone season for me, and I needed a vacation. I needed to go to the Hamptons. I suggested this to Evelyn, and like a spider, she accepted. The house we stayed at was actually Tim Price's, which Evelyn had the keys to for some reason, but in my stupefied state I refused to ask for specifics. Tim's house was on the water in East Hampton, and was adorned with many gable roofs and was 4 stories high, all connected by a galvanized steel staircase, and had what at first I thought was a southwestern motif, but wasn't. The kitchen was 1,000 square feet of pure minimalist design. One wall held everything. 2 huge ovens, massive cupboards, a walk-in freezer, a 3-door refrigerator. An island of custom-crafted stainless steel divided the kitchen into 3 separate spaces. 4 of the 9 bathrooms contained trompe-l'oeil paintings, and 5 of them had antique lead ram's heads that hung over the sink, water spouting from their mouths. All the sinks and bathtubs and showers were antique marble, and the floors were composed of tiny marble mosaics. A television was built into a wall alcove above the master bathtub. Every room had a stereo. The house also contained 12 Frank Lloyd Wright standing lamps, 14 Joseph Hefferman club chairs, 2 walls of floor-to-ceiling video cassette cases, and another wall stacked solely with thousands of compact discs encased in glass cabinets. A chandelier by Eric Schmidt hung in the front entranceway, Below it stood an atomic ironworks steel moose hat rack by a young sculptor I'd never heard of. A round 19th century Russian dining table sat in a room adjacent to the kitchen, but had no chairs. Spooky photographs by Cindy Sherman lined the walls everywhere. There was an exercise room. There were 8 walk-in closets, 5 VCRs, a Noguchi glass and walnut dining table, a hall table by Mark Schaefer, and a fax machine. There was a topiary tree in the master bedroom next to a Louis XVI window bench. An Eric Fischel painting hung over one of the marble fireplaces. There was a tennis court. There were 2 saunas and an indoor jacuzzi in a small guest house that sat by the pool, which was black-bottomed. There were stone columns in odd places. I really tried to make things work the weeks we were out there. Evelyn and I rode bicycles and jogged and played tennis. We talked about going to the south of France or to Scotland. We talked about driving through Germany and visiting unspoiled opera houses. We went windsurfing. We talked about only romantic things, the light on eastern Long Island, the moonrise in October over the hills of the Virginia Hunt country. We took baths together in the big marble tubs. We had breakfast in bed, snuggling beneath cashmere blankets after I'd poured imported coffee from a Melior pot into Hermes cups. I woke her up with fresh flowers. I put notes in her Louis Vuitton carry bag before she left for her weekly facials in Manhattan. I bought her a puppy, a small black chow, which she named NutraSweet, and fed dietetic chocolate truffles to. I read long passages aloud from Dr. Zhivago and A Farewell to Arms, my favorite Hemingway. I rented movies in town that Price didn't own, mostly comedies from the 1930s, and played them on one of the many VCRs, our favorite being Roman Holiday, which we watched twice. We listened to Frank Sinatra, only his 1950s period, and Nat King Cole's After Midnight, which Tim had on CD. I bought her expensive lingerie, which sometimes she wore. After skinny dipping in the ocean late at night, we would come into the house, shivering, draped in huge Ralph Lauren towels, and we'd make omelets and noodles tossed with olive oil and truffles and porcini mushrooms. We'd make soufflés with poached pears and cinnamon fruit salads, grilled polenta with peppered salmon, apple and berry sorbet, mascarpone, red beans with orzo wrapped in romaine lettuce, bowls of salsa and skate poached in balsamic vinegar, chilled tomato soup and risottos flavored with beets and lime and asparagus and mint, and we drank lemonade or champagne or well-aged bottles of Chateau Margaux. But soon we stopped lifting weights together and swimming laps, and Evelyn would eat only the dietetic chocolate truffles that NutraSweet hadn't eaten, complaining about weight she hadn't gained. Some nights I would find myself roaming the beaches, digging up baby crabs and eating handfuls of sand. This was in the middle of the night when the sky was so clear I could see the entire solar system, and the sand lit by it seemed almost lunar in scale. I even dragged a beach jellyfish back to the house and microwaved it early one morning, pre-dawn, while Evelyn slept, and what I didn't eat of it I fed to the chow. Sipping bourbon, then champagne, from cactus-etched highball glasses, which Evelyn would set on adobe coasters, and into which she would stir raspberry cassis with papier-mâché jalapeno-shaped stirrers, I would lie around, fantasizing about killing someone with an Alsop racer ski pole, or I would stare at the antique weather vane that hung above one of the fireplaces, wondering wild-eyed if I could stab anyone with it. Then I'd complain aloud, whether Evelyn was in the room or not, that we should have made reservations at Dick Loudon's Stratford Inn instead. Evelyn soon started talking only about spas and cosmetic surgery, and then she hired a masseur, some scary faggot who lived down the road with a famous book publisher and who flirted openly with me. Evelyn went back to the city 3 times that last week we were in the Hamptons, once for a manicure and a pedicure and a facial, the second time for a one-on-one training session at Stephanie Herman, and finally to meet with her astrologer. "Why Helicopter Inn?" I asked in a whisper. "What do you want me to do?" she shrieked, popping another dietetic truffle into her mouth. "Rent a Volvo?" While she was gone, I would vomit, just to do it, into the rustic terracotta jars that lined the patio in front, or I would drive into town with the scary masseur and collect razor blades. At night, I'd place a faux concrete and aluminum wire sconce by Jerry Cott over Evelyn's head, and since she'd be so knocked out on Halcyon, she wouldn't brush it off. And though I laughed at this while the sconce rose evenly with her deep breathing, soon it made me sad, and I stopped placing the sconce over Evelyn's head. Everything failed to subdue me. Soon everything seemed dull. Another sunrise, the lives of heroes, falling in love, war, the discoveries people made about each other. The only thing that didn't bore me, obviously enough, was how much money Tim Price made, and yet in its obviousness it did. There wasn't a clear, identifiable emotion within me, except for greed and possibly total disgust. I had all the characteristics of a human being, flesh, blood, skin, hair, but my depersonalization was so intense, had gone so deep, that the normal ability to feel compassion had been eradicated, the victim of a slow, purposeful erasure. I was simply imitating reality, a rough resemblance of a human being, with only a dim corner of my mind functioning. Something horrible was happening, and yet I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't put my finger on it. The only thing that calmed me was the satisfying sound of ice being dropped into a glass of J&B. Eventually I drowned the chow, which Evelyn didn't miss. She didn't even notice its absence, not even when I threw it in the walk-in freezer, wrapped in one of her sweaters from Bergdorf Goodman. We had to leave the Hamptons because I would find myself standing over our bed in the hours before dawn, with an ice pick gripped in my fist, waiting for Evelyn to open her eyes. At my suggestion, one morning over breakfast, she agreed, and on the last Sunday before Labor Day, we returned to Manhattan by helicopter.
Girls.
I thought the pinto beans with salmon and mint were really, really, you know,
Elizabeth says, walking into the living room of my apartment, and in one graceful movement kicking off both satin and suede Maud Frison pumps and flopping onto the couch.
Good, but Patrick, my God, it was expensive.
And then, bristling, she bitches,
it was only pseudo-Nivelle.
Was it my imagination, or were there goldfish on the tables? I ask, undoing my Brooks Brothers suspenders while searching the refrigerator for a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. Anyway, I thought it was hip. Christy has taken a seat on the long, wide sofa, away from Elizabeth, who stretches out lazily.
Hip, Patrick, she calls out. Donald Trump eats there.
I locate the bottle and stand it on the counter, and before finding a wine opener, stare at her blankly from across the room. Yes? Is this a sarcastic comment?
Guess, she moans and follows it with a duh so loud that Christy flinches.
Where are you working now, Elizabeth? I ask, closing drawers. Polo outlet or something? Elizabeth cracks up at this and says blithely, while I uncork the acacia,
I don't have to work, Bateman.
And after a beat, she adds, bored,
you of all people should know how that feels. Mr. Wall Street.
She's checking her lipstick in a Gucci compact. Predictably, it looks perfect. Changing the subject, I ask, who chose that place anyway? I pour the two girls wine and then make myself a J&B on the rocks with a little water. The restaurant, I mean.
Carson did. Or maybe Robert.
Elizabeth shrugs and then, after snapping the compact shut, staring intently at Christy, asks,
you look really familiar. Did you go to Dalton?
Christy shakes her head no. It's almost 3 in the morning. I'm grinding up a tab of ecstasy and watching it dissolve in the wine glass I planned to hand Elizabeth. This morning's topic on the Patty Winters show was people who weigh over 700 pounds. What can we do about them? I switch on the kitchen lights, find 2 more tabs of the drug in the freezer, then shut the lights off. Elizabeth is a 20-year-old hardbody who sometimes models in George Marchino ads and who comes from an old Virginia banking family. We had dinner earlier tonight with 2 friends of hers, Robert Farrell, 27, a guy who's had a rather sketchy career as a financier, and Carson Whittall, who was Robert's date. Robert wore a wool suit by Bell Vest, a cotton shirt with French cuffs by Charvet, an abstract patterned silk crepe tie by Hugo Boss, and sunglasses by Ray-Ban, that he insisted on wearing during the meal. Carson wore a suit by Yves Saint Laurent Rive Gauche, and a pearl necklace with matching pearl and diamond earrings by Harry Winston. We had dinner at Free Spin, the new Albert Lyman restaurant in the Flatiron District, then took the limousine to Nell's, where I excused myself, assuring an irate Elizabeth I'd be right back, and directed the chauffeur to the meatpacking district, where I picked up Christy. I made her wait in the back of the locked limousine while I re-entered Nell's and had drinks with Elizabeth and Carson and Robert in one of the booths up front, empty since the place had no celebrities in it tonight, a bad sign. Finally, at 2:30, while Carson bragged drunkenly about her monthly flower bill, Elizabeth and I split. She was so pissed off about something Carson told her was in the latest issue of W that she didn't even question Christie's presence. In the ride back toward Nell's, Christy had admitted that she was still upset about the last time we shared together and that she had major reservations about tonight. But the money I've offered is simply too good to pass up, and I promised her that nothing like last time will be repeated. Though she was still scared, a few shots of vodka in the back of the limo, along with the money I'd given her so far, over $1,600, relaxed her like a tranquilizer. Her moodiness turned me on, and she acted like a total sex kitten when I first handed her the cash amount, 6 bills attached to a Hewland silver money clip. But after I urged her into the limo, she told me that she might need surgery after what happened last time, or a lawyer. So I wrote out a check to cash in the amount of $1,000, but since I knew it would never be cashed, I didn't have a panic attack about it or anything. Looking over at Elizabeth right now in my apartment, I'm noticing how well endowed she is in the chest area, and I'm hoping that after the ecstasy hits her system, I can convince the two girls to have sex in front of me. Elizabeth is asking Christy if she's ever met some asshole named Spicy or been to O-Bar. Christy is shaking her head. I hand Elizabeth the ecstasy-laden Sauvignon Blanc while she stares at Christy like she was from Neptune, and after recovering from Christy's admission, she yawns. Anyway, O-Bar sucks now. It's terrible. I went to a birthday party there for Malcolm Forbes. Oh my God, please. She downs the wine, grimacing. I take a seat in one of the chrome and oak sot-sass chairs and reach over to the ice bucket that sits on the glass-top coffee table, adjusting the bottle of wine in order to chill it better. Immediately, Elizabeth makes a move for it, pouring herself another glass. I dissolve 2 more tabs of the ecstasy in the bottle before bringing it into the living room. A sullen Christy sips her untainted wine cautiously and tries not to stare at the floor. She still seems scared, and finding the silence unbearable or incriminating, she asks Elizabeth where she met me. Oh, God, Elizabeth starts moaning as if she falsely remembered something embarrassing. I met Patrick at, oh, God, the Kentucky Derby in 86? No, 87. And, she turns to me, you were hanging out with that bimbo Allison something. Stool?
Pool, honey, I reply calmly. Allison Pool.
Yeah, that was her name, she says, then with unmasked sarcasm, hot number.
What do you mean by that? I ask, offended. She was a hot number.
Elizabeth turns to Christy and unfortunately says, if you had an American Express card, she'd give you a blowjob. And I'm hoping to God that Christy doesn't look over at Elizabeth confused and say, but we don't take credit cards. To make sure this doesn't happen, I bellow, oh, bullshit, but good-naturedly. Listen, Elizabeth tells Christy, holding her hand out like a fag offering gossipy information. This girl worked at a tanning salon, and in the same sentence without changing tone, what do you do? After a long silence, Christy turning redder and even more scared, I say, she's my cousin. Slowly, Elizabeth takes this in and says,
uh-huh.
After another long silence, I say, she's from France. Elizabeth looks at me skeptically, like I'm completely crazy, but chooses not to pursue this line of questioning and asks instead, where's your phone? I've got to call Harley. I move over to the kitchen and bring the cordless phone to her, pulling up its antenna. She dials a number and, while waiting for someone to answer, stares at Christy.
Where do you summer? She asks. Southampton?
Christy looks at me and then back at Elizabeth and quietly says,
no.
Oh, God, Elizabeth wails. It's his machine.
Elizabeth, I point at my Rolex, it's 3 in the morning.
He's a goddamn drug dealer, she says, exasperated. These are his peak hours.
Don't tell him you're here, I warn.
Why would I? She asks.
Distracted, she reaches for her wine and downs another full glass and makes a face.
This tastes weird.
She checks the label, then shrugs.
Harley, it's me. I need your services. Translate that any way you'd like to. I'm at...
She looks over at me.
You're at Marcus Halberstam's, I whisper.
Who? Leaning in, she grins mischievously.
Marcus Halberstam, I whisper again. I want the number, idiot.
She waves me away and continues.
Anyway, I'm at Mark Hammerstein's, and I'll try you later. And if I don't see you at Canal Bar tomorrow night, I'm going to sic my hairdresser on you. Bon voyage. How do I hang this thing up?
She asks, even though she expertly pushes the antenna down and presses the off button, tossing the phone onto the Schrager chair that I've moved next to the jukebox. See, I smile. You did it. 20 minutes later, Elizabeth is squirming on the couch and I'm trying to coerce her into having sex with Christy in front of me. What started out as a casual suggestion is now at the forefront of my brain, and I'm insistent. Christy stares impassively at a stain I hadn't noticed on the white oak floor, her wine mostly untouched.
But I'm not a lesbian, Elizabeth protests again, giggling. I'm not into girls.
Is this a firm no? I ask, staring at her glass, then at the near-empty bottle of wine.
Why do you think I'd be into that? She asks.
Because of the ecstasy, the question is flirtatious, and she seems genuinely interested. Her foot is rubbing against my thigh. I've moved over to the couch, sitting between the two girls, and I'm massaging one of her calves. Well, you went to Sarah Lawrence, for one thing, I tell her. You never know.
Those are Sarah Lawrence guys, Patrick, she points out, giggling, rubbing harder, causing friction, heat, everything.
Well, I'm sorry, I admit. I don't usually deal with a lot of guys who wear pantyhose on the street.
Patrick, you went to Patrick. I mean, Harvard. Oh, God, I'm so drunk. Anyway, listen, I mean, wait.
She pauses, takes a deep breath, mumbles an unintelligible remark about feeling bizarre, then, after closing her eyes, opens them and asks,
Do you have any coke?
I'm staring at her glass, noticing that the dissolved ecstasy has slightly changed the color of the wine. She follows my gaze and takes a gulp of it, as if it were some kind of elixir that could soothe her increasing agitation. She leans her head back, woozily, on one of the pillows on the couch.
Or halcyon. I'd take a halcyon.
Listen, I would just like to see the two of you get it on, I say innocently. What's wrong with that? It's totally disease-free.
Patrick, she laughs, you're a lunatic.
Come on, I urge. Don't you find Christy attractive?
Let's not get lewd, she says,
but the drug is kicking in, and I can sense that she's excited but doesn't want to be.
I'm in no mood to have lewd conversation.
Come on, I say. I think it would be a turn-on.
Does he do this all the time? Elizabeth asks Christy.
I look over at Christy. Christy shrugs, noncommittal, and studies the back of a compact disc before setting it on the table next to the stereo. Are you telling me you've never gotten it on with a girl? I ask, touching a black stocking, then, beneath it, a leg.
But I'm not a lesbian, she stresses, and no, I never have.
Never, I ask, arching my eyebrows. Well, there's always a first time.
You're making me feel weird,
Elizabeth moans, losing control of her facial features.
I'm not, I say, shocked.
Elizabeth is making out with Christy, both of them naked on my bed, all the lights in the room burning, while I sit in the Louis Montoni chair by the side of the futon, watching them very closely, occasionally repositioning their bodies. Now I make Elizabeth lie on her back and hold both legs up, open, spreading them as wide as possible, and then I push Christy's head down and make her lap at her cunt. not suck on it, but lap at it like a thirsty dog, while fingering the clit. Then with her other hand she sticks two fingers into the open, wet cunt, while her tongue replaces the fingers. And then she takes the dripping fingers she's fucked Elizabeth's cunt with and forces them into Elizabeth's mouth, making her suck on them. Then I have Christy lie on top of Elizabeth and make her suck and bite at Elizabeth's full, swollen tits, which Elizabeth is also squeezing. And then I tell the two of them to kiss each other hard. And Elizabeth takes the tongue that's been licking at her own small pink cunt into her mouth hungrily, like an animal, and uncontrollably they start humping each other, pressing their cunts together, Elizabeth moaning loudly, wrapping her legs around Christy's hips, bucking up against her. Christy's legs spread in such a way that, from behind, I can see her cunt,